Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the Punk Rock NBA Podcast.
Really quickly, before we get into this episode, I wanted to mention my Patreon. Patrons get all of the podcasts a week early. I do giveaways. I do some other stuff. But most importantly, if you want me to review your music or artwork or anything else, Patreon is the way to do that. Every month, I do a call for submissions. All you need to do if you want me to review something is just post it in the comments of that post. Then I will review it live on Twitch for the hundreds of people that tune into every stream and post it on Patreon for everyone to check out. All you need to do is just join at the $10 and up level. Stay tuned for that post and you are good to go. So if that sounds cool to you and you want me to review your music, artwork, or anything else, hit the link in the show notes for this episode. And thank you very much to everyone who supports over on Patreon. Tank the Tech, welcome to the show. Thank you for making time for this. Does it say Tank on your birth certificate?
Hell no.
Your mom didn't name you Tank the Tech?
No, definitely not. And it's funny, I know everybody asks that as a joke, but that, like, so many people have asked, like, is Tank a real name? And I was like, of course not.
I mean, listen, you never know. You see the kids now, you know, my wife and I have been looking at nurseries. They got all kinds of, like, Sarah Palin's kid track. People have wild names these days. Who knows?
Dude, I was on a flight the other day and there was a kid behind me and I kept hearing the parents yelling at their kid, like, stop doing that. Kid's name was Rocket. That was his name. I was like, yes.
See? So yeah. Maybe it's not such a stupid question after all.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe not. No, who knows? My actual given name is Ian, believe it or not.
I would change it to Tank. Well, I want to get into your background and all that stuff and talk about how you ended up on YouTube and give people an idea of who you are. But
yeah,
let's start with something spicy, a hot topic that a lot of people have asked me about. And I always kind of defer and say, you know, I'm not really qualified to answer this question, but you are, which is the topic of venue merch splits. These bands, like, I mean, everyone's complained about it, but I guess most recently, probably Architects saying, you know, why are venues taking 30% of our merch sales or whatever it is? Can you explain that to everybody and give them an idea of, like, why is that a thing? And why don't artists collectively just say, no, we're not doing this anymore?
So it's wild that this is coming up so much now, because this is like, this isn't new. This has been going on for decades. And I'm just a little surprised that all of a sudden it's right now. But, you know, for people that don't know me, you know, most people on YouTube know me as a guitar, drum, bass tech, stuff like that. I started my career in the music industry doing merchandise for bands. And I've done everything from small, you know, dive bar clubs to stadiums doing merchandise. So this is something I've dealt with a lot. And at every level, these merch fees exist in some form or another. It's a rare occasion when there's no merch fee. Now, it's kind of wild because it is almost expected now that a band is going to have to pay a merch fee, but this is the fee that they pay for essentially renting the space in the venue to sell their merchandise. That's how the venues justify it. And the bands, rightfully so, hate that they have to give 20, 30, sometimes in extreme cases, 35 or 40% to venues because they feel as though like this is our money and you're basically just taking money that we need for the road. And
30% or whatever, right off the top.
So it shouldn't be right off the top, but a lot of bands do that because they don't know better. Like I'm really into the accounting aspect of merchandise. So when a band sells merchandise, you've got your gross sales of the night. That's like total sales. Then you got to take out the taxes in your local area because that band is going to pay taxes on everything they sold. Then there's credit card fees and stuff like that. And then after all that is taken out, that adjusted gross total is what a band should be paying on. But some bands don't know this. And when they walk into a venue, if they've made, you know, $5,000, they're still paying $1,000 of that to the venue when they really should have taken the taxes and stuff out first. Now, when bands pay these fees, again, the venues justify it by saying, well, you're using our space and it's basically a rental fee. But bands would make the argument that nobody would be here if we weren't here anyway. So it's a constant battle. The big problem with this, and the reason why I don't think bands have a right to complain about it right now, is because it's in every single one of their contracts. And that is the big issue, is that their agents are signing the show deals that have 20, 30, 40% built in. So while that sucks, the band, like I remember when Alpha Wolf was on stage in that video and they were trashing the venue and they're like, yeah, right, this, you know, we got to pay 20% and blah, blah, blah. And then in that same video, their guitar player was like, you know, we paid it because it was in our contract. And I'm like, right there, I'm like, your argument has no justification if you have signed a deal that says you're going to pay that. Now, the big issue that I have is that merch fees have become such a commonplace now that sometimes they're not built into the contracts and the venues will still go try and collect, hoping that the band is naive enough to have not looked at their contract. So there
Shady as hell.
Dude, there are bands out there that are giving promoters and venues 20% of their merch fees when merchandise was never even negotiated in their contract. So that's the whole situation is so weird and really, you know, sucky for for all the bands, because the thing that they would have to do right now is every single band would have to and tell their agents, we're not playing shows that have merch fees anymore. The problem is, the venues have all the advantage right now. And they're like, fine, well, you're just not going to play here. It would take every band in the industry to like kind of go on a tour strike until merchandise fees are lifted for this to change. Because when you've got Live Nation and AEG with a grip on every venue that these bands are touring to, that's a whole, it's not like they cannot play one venue and the rest of the tour is fine. Chances are if they're playing one Live Nation venue, they're playing 20 of them.
Yeah.
So the bands have no advantage in this argument. The agents are just going to keep signing off on it because it's part of the standard deal. And it's such a common thing now that.
And they also, and I don't want to get too into the weeds of it, but they don't get paid on merch. So they don't really care.
Yeah. Like if agents got an incentive, like if they got like a bonus for getting rid of a merch fee or something, they'd get rid of them fast. Right. Dude. Like, you know, business is business. And until that agent's bottom line is affected by something like this, they're not going to care, you know?
So basically, if I understand it correctly, the issue is that, well, there's a few issues, but the main one being that because there isn't anyone, there aren't enough artists who are willing to take a stand on this or able and just say, we're going to boycott any venue that wants a cut of merch. There aren't enough of these artists who would be willing to take that stand that it basically isn't going to change.
It won't change. I'm telling you right now, like I know there's petitions in the UK that have been going around where venues are signing things saying we're not going to take merch fees. At least in North America, I don't see it happening. And one of the big things like you just brought up, I've kind of gotten in comment sections on Instagram about this because I see other big artists that chime in and they're like, yeah, like people that are verified on Instagram, like bands that are big arena touring bands that will chime in and be like, yeah, venues are stealing from us. And I want to be like, dude, you know how this works.
Yeah.
Like, it's in your contract. Don't feed this narrative, you know. But then I've seen other smaller bands that have been like, dude, I hear what you're saying. Like, we should not play these venues. But for a smaller band like us, we can't afford to not have this venue to play a show at. So in a lot of cases, these bands are stuck with the only option of playing a show in their local area at a venue that requires a merch fee. And I mean, I did a video on my channel where I was breaking down an actual show that I did on tour where like our gross total for the night, it was a small club show. I think it was from the show box out in Seattle, like near kind of your area.
Yeah.
It was like a 10 grand sales night. And then after taxes and the fees and everything that came out, it's like that band is really taking home like 40% of that, if not less. So there, you know, bands have to rely on the stuff on the road.
And that's a pretty big venue.
Yeah. Like merchandise is what keeps bands, I would say mid to low tier bands, like smaller tours, like that's what keeps them afloat on the road. When I was in a band, $1,000 merch night would be the difference between us sleeping in the van or possibly all five of us sharing one room in a hotel for the night, you know, like, so it kind of sucks, but I don't see anything changing anytime soon. And like I said, it would be impossible to get every band to just boycott all these venues. It would be impossible.
Right. Do you think if someone like Taylor Swift was to like really put her foot, Taylor Swift or Drake or someone like that, but Taylor seems to be the one that, you know, sort of takes a stand on these things. Do you think that would change anything?
I think it would bring the conversation to a bigger audience for sure. Here's the problem with an artist like Taylor Swift compared to a club band though. And this is something that needs to be brought up too. And I apologize, I didn't bring this up sooner. There are different situations with merchandise. A lot of these bands that are complaining, rightfully so, are playing in clubs where the venue does nothing for them. Right. They just say, there's your corner, set up your stuff, sell it. And at the end of the night, we're taking 20%. An artist like Drake or Taylor Swift or any like arena touring band,
they actually do stuff.
These arenas have, they have merchandise teams. So my day working merchandise for a club band is drastically different than say, if I was out doing an arena tour, because in a club, I do everything. I set up, I sell, I physically do everything all day. In an arena, all the merchandise on the tour gets counted in with the arena's merchandise staff. And then once you agree on numbers, that merchandise is theirs for the day. They set up multiple stands, they sell everything, they display everything. Then at the end of the night, you count out what's left and they cut you a check. So essentially, a merchandise manager on an arena or stadium tour has become an accountant at this point.
Right.
And the team at the venue literally does all the work all day. So in that case,
and it's totally fair to take a percentage for that.
You have to pay that staff that's working at the arena because that's how they make their money, from that merchandise fee. So in that situation, I have no problem with merchandise fees. I do have the problem with the club band that is being told, there's your dark, not lit corner with no tables and racks. Go do whatever you need to do. And then you're giving us 20% at the end of the night.
For a Walmart card table.
Dude, yeah. I've been to some clubs where it's like merch is an afterthought. And it's like, if you're going to take 20% from the band that's playing here, that shouldn't be an afterthought. So I don't see it changing anytime soon at all, to be honest.
People like Franz from Attila and a few other people have said, well, if you get a cut of merch, why don't we get a cut of the bar? Since we're the ones who are bringing people here to sell drinks.
It's a decent argument. If I'm being 100% honest with you, I feel like I'm not knowledgeable enough in bar sales and how that works to really give an opinion. But I do know that the markup on drinks at shows is like astronomical. Like what these venues are playing or paying for beer and liquor, and then what they're selling it for, they're making a huge profit. So I don't know why that couldn't be negotiated by an agent too. Maybe because the venue does have all that power and on their side of the argument. And they're like, no, we're not doing that.
I think that's what it comes down to, is like, you get what you negotiate for. If you are Taylor Swift or Drake or whoever, you know that you're going to sell out this arena. So you have a lot of leverage. If you're whatever random metalcore band that's going to draw 400 people tonight, they're like, all right, then don't play here on Tuesday. We don't care.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the things too is that, you know, you got to think, not every show is a sellout. So like, if you're talking that club band that promoter brought in and they only sold like 200 tickets, chances are that promoter probably is losing money anyways.
Right.
And I know promoters, when they want merch fees, that's like a safety net. It's like a, you know, if this show doesn't do well, at least I'm going to get a little kickback from the merchandise sales,
which is fair.
Yeah.
You know, they got to make their money.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, the bar sales thing, I feel like that would be a good medium or like a middle point for the bands and the venues to reach. But I also feel as though bar sales are probably higher than merchandise in a lot of situations.
Yeah.
And the venues aren't going to want to give more money to the band than they're getting from their merch.
But, you know, there's some bands I saw. Do you remember that band Forever the Sickest Kids by any chance?
Yeah, absolutely.
I saw them sort of randomly in like 2008 or 2009. Nobody there was over 21.
Also a great point.
There were literally like one mom at the bar on her phone. The bartenders were looking bored as hell. And I have to imagine that the venue was not super happy about that night. And in that situation, it's kind of like, well, I would sort of understand, as much as I hate the merch cut thing. It's like, well, we made $100 on alcohol tonight. Like, yeah, we got to make our money somehow.
Yeah. And that's just another variable to a live show. And it's a great point to bring up, because there are those bands who have like, I'll tell you right now, I did a tour with like Nick Jonas when he first went solo doing his merchandise. Uh-huh. Merchandise sales crushed, obviously, but everybody at the show was under 21. Like it was like late teenagers. So it's right. Like the venues aren't, the shows are sold out. They did great, but they're not making that extra money from the bar. So in that situation, that'd be talked about. But my like take on the whole situation is, if a venue is helping and actually doing work for the band, then a merch fee should be negotiated. But if it's that club that's just pointing to a corner and saying, go set up and do your thing and we're going to collect at the end of the night, those should be scratched from contracts. But again, it all goes back to the contract. If it's in the contract that the band's agent has signed, the band literally has no argument.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Nick Jonas, let's talk about your background a little bit, because From what I understand, you have worked on a lot of like really big tours with, you know, you've played in this world of giant major label arena type artists and stuff that I know absolutely nothing about. So tell us your life story, at least the professional side of it.
Okay. Yeah. I'll give you a just quick rundown. So my band that I was in when I was in college, I was a bass player, started kind of taking off. So I dropped out of college to tour with my band. We toured for 3 years. We never got signed, but we did a lot of big package tours. Like back in the day, we were getting opening slots with like A Day to Remember, All Time Low. But then our music was also, I don't want to say versatile. It's not like we're like, you know, trying to sound special, but our music could appeal to harder crowds, but also to like mainstream rock crowds. So we did tours with like Trapped and stuff back in the day.
Pre-Meltdown?
Yeah, it was pre-Meltdown, but he was still an interesting guy back then. But anyways, 3 years of touring in a band, just the five of us in a van and trailer, it was the brokest I've ever been in my life. Like I never had more than like $10 in my bank account. Like there were days where I just didn't eat because we didn't have money, and that lifestyle gets tiring. So one of the bands that I was touring with, or that we were opening for, I kind of told them I was thinking about quitting my band. And they're like, if you do, we'll hire you to come work for us. And that was the start of me working for bands. And that was like 2008. So the first few years I was touring, I was actually touring with Christian bands, which is kind of funny for me. I went from working for, my first gig ever was for a band called Red. I don't know if you're familiar. They're like Christian metal band. They do a lot of stuff with like Skillet. Like they have that kind of sound, like symphonic metal, you know. And then worked for some other like, you know, Christian contemporary bands, just because that's what's really big in Nashville. It's easy to find work.
Sure.
And then I got real tired of that scene. And the first offer I had after Christian bands was Nickelback. I went from working for Christian bands to Nickelback doing merchandise. And that's where I started like really learning about merchandise.
I mean, that's got to be kind of a, I don't want to say a trial by fire, but I imagine Nickelback's merch does crazy business and they're playing enormous shows. So like, whether you like their music or not, being able to work for something that big is cool.
Dude, it was super cool. And what is crazy about doing merchandise for Nickelback, and I still say this, is we sold so much merch because it was an arena tour, you know, sold out arenas all over North America. I've never seen one person in public wearing a Nickelback shirt ever.
Never. My life.
Like,
and yet they're selling 10,000 shirts a night or whatever.
Oh, dude. I mean, easily. Like, it's ridiculous. We sold so much merch on that tour, and I've never seen anybody sporting Nickelback stuff in public. I find that so funny.
Never.
And then for quite a few years, I did a lot of classic rock bands, and it was kind of interesting. Like, I went from Nickelback to Van Halen. I did the Van Halen reunion tour in 2012.
Wow.
Met a lot of great people. And that was kind of like my, I guess, for lack of a better word, my coming of age tour. I was like 22 or 23. And I got to admit, like, I just was a cocky young kid. I was like, I got the Van Halen tour, I'm the shit. And then I got out there and realized very quickly that all these older road dogs that have been out here for decades, like they didn't like me. I'll say it right now. Like, I learned the hard way with Tough Love that, like
for good reason or.
Yeah. I was a young, cocky, dumb kid that, like, because I've only been touring for, like, you know, 4 years working for bands, and all of a sudden got a legacy act like that. I was just very arrogant and dumb about it. I learned, like, Tough Love on that tour. It was like, this is how you need to act on a tour. So very quickly, I just kind of kept my mouth shut, did my work, you know, learned from a lot of the older guys. And by the end of that tour, it was like 5 or 6 months. It was like I had made friends with everybody out there, and I really grew up and learned how to, like, act on tour. After that, I spent a few years working for Pat Benatar, which was pretty wild. Her and her husband are phenomenal people. Then after that, I kind of started, like, branching out into what I'm doing now, like more guitar tech, backline, you know, drums and stuff like that. You know, through the years, it's been, you know, Walk Off the Earth was another band I was with for a while. Then I did Nick Jonas. I did the Sick Puppies for a very quick second. Lifehouse, Faith No More. And then from 2015 till the pandemic, I started working in country in Nashville. I was working for an artist named Dustin Lynch. And I like some country. Country is not normally my scene, but it's great touring. Country music really takes care of their crew. It was the most comfortable I've been on tour. It's the reason I was there for 6 years.
It seems like a very professional industry in general.
It is. It's run very well. Everybody in the country genre of the industry, super professional. I will say the partying in the country industry is, like, harder than anything. Like, they party harder on the country tours I've been on than on the Nickelback tour I was on. It's insane.
Interesting.
And when I say that, I'm not talking like drugs or anything. It's just like they know how to drink, man. And they do. It's like, I always joke that it's almost a job requirement that you have to, like, just pound alcohol on country tours. And that is one of the reasons I'm sober now. Like, it was too much. I just stopped.
Did you have a problem, or just felt like you were over it, or what led you to do that?
I would say I had a problem. Absolutely. I have no shame in telling people, like, I was absolutely a full-blown alcoholic.
Okay.
It never got to a point where it affected my marriage or my job or anything like that. But it was like, it was an everyday.
You could see it kind of heading in that direction.
Yeah. I consider myself fortunate. I got sober before anything, like, really drastic happened. But the potential was there. If I was still drinking today, I would probably have ruined my entire job and everything. So there were incidents that happened on the road, and there was one specific thing that led me to being like, I'm done. But it wasn't anything that did, like, affect, again, like, my job, my marriage, my life, anything like that. It was just, it was a wake up moment. It was a wake up moment on tour where I was just like, I'm done.
Is that something you can talk about or no?
Yeah, I could. And over the years, I had these incidents. Like, I was the kind of drinker where I didn't drink during the day. I always had this rule for myself that if somebody's paying me to work, I'm not drinking while I'm working. But the second the shows got done, it was like, it was on. Like, I was an absolute animal. Every year, Luke Bryan does this festival in Cancun, Mexico, called Crash My Playa. The ticket is an insane price, but it includes your flights and a week stay at an all-inclusive resort. And they build a stage on the beach, and they bring down all these big country bands every year. And there's 4 shows that week, Wednesday through Saturday. Everybody parties during the day. They go to the show at night. And every year we went down there, you know, we'd go for a week and we'd only have one show. So what do we do the whole time we're there? We just party. And one of the years we went down there, day one, I'll try and keep this story as short as possible while hitting the details. I just got annihilated, wasted. And for some reason, I was at the hotel bar that night, and Dustin, who I was working for at the time, his manager walked into the bar, a person that I did not like and had a lot of problems with. For some reason, in my blacked out, drunken rage, I saw him. I decided I don't like him. I'm going to do something about it.
Oh, boy.
And I like kicked out my bar stool, went over to him, like threw him into a wall and started yelling at him. I don't remember this. Like, I was completely blackout wasted. This is all story that I was told.
Wow.
Basically physically assaulted the manager of the guy I was working for. And then the next day, like woke up.
This is a big artist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You don't want to be messing with his manager.
Yeah. And the next day, I don't remember a thing. I just woke up in my hotel room and was like hungover and like, oh, last night was crazy. And everybody was texting me and like, dude, it's like you messed up. That was my moment where I was like, I have to be done. Like, alcohol has controlled my actions and my personality too much to the point now where I feel like I'm out of control. And I will say, to Dustin's credit and this manager, at our next show, when we got home to the States, they called me into the tour production office, and I thought I was getting fired, like 100% yeah, for sure.
Rightfully so.
Yeah, at 100%. Any other gig, I think I would have got fired. But they came to me from a place of concern and care rather than like bringing just full on wrath. They sat me down and were just like, you know, all right, you know what happened when we were in Mexico? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, are you okay? And I was like, what? They're like, we just, you know, over the last year, these incidents and your drinking has been getting like worse and worse and worse. Like, are you okay? Like, is there something going on? Is there something you need to talk about? Anything like that? And I was so blown away. It was so, I was like in tears because I was emotional. I couldn't believe they came to me and actually cared enough to talk to me about it. To this day, I will give them that credit for just, you know, not a lot of people would have done that.
That's really cool.
Yeah. A lot of other people probably would have been like, you're a drunk asshole, you're off this tour. They actually came to me from a sincere point of concern. And that was my moment where I was just like, I'm done. And I haven't touched anything since, like no drugs, no alcohol, no nothing.
Well, I'm happy to hear that.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan. And this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services, DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, You can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player, and when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too, to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like, I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, you know, you're wearing a Children of Bodom hoodie right now. You've got, you know, Electric Callboy and whatever, you know, metal records. Like, you're a metal guy, but you've worked primarily, but at least on a lot of non-metal tours with artists where I'm sure you don't necessarily love their music. And I think a lot of people have this idea that you can't be happy unless you're working on a product or type of music or whatever that you personally like. In my experience, so like, I did a lot of stuff for like Swiffer and Febreze and stuff like that, mm-hmm. that I thought was going to be really boring, but it turns out it was actually really interesting and fun, in large part because I loved the people that I was working with, even though, you know, I never gave two shits about Swiffer necessarily as a product, but the people were cool. The businesses were run very well. What are your kind of thoughts on that as far as, you know, enjoying, like, the difference between like enjoying working with someone versus enjoying their music? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually love that you brought that up, because you're one of the people on YouTube that I love right now that, like, while you do have your certain style of music that you seem to gravitate to, you like a lot of other things. And I'm the same way. Like, everybody pegs me as this brutal metalhead, but like, I love a lot of different kinds of music. I listen to a lot of hip hop and rap. I listen to a lot of pop. I listen to country here and there. I listen to a lot of techno. Like, I do gravitate towards metal, but I like a lot of other things. So that being said, I'm 100% honest. I've never worked on a tour where I like disliked the music that was being played.
Okay.
I have found a way to enjoy everything I've ever worked on. And I think that, especially working in the music industry, if you enjoy the actual job that you're doing on the road, whether it was the merchandise or guitar teching or drum teching, you can find a way to enjoy everything else. So while the current state of like bro country, for lack of a better term, is not what I would normally turn on while I'm sitting at home, I thoroughly enjoyed Dustin sets every night.
Sure.
I thoroughly enjoyed listening to Florida Georgia Line when we were touring with them. The shows are good. The songs are fun and catchy. Like, I'm the kind of person that when it comes to music, if it makes you feel good or makes you feel something, enjoy it. That too many people base their entire identities and personalities around the genre they like.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, you see that in metal so much because it's like, it's not metal. Blah. And I'll admit, when I was 16, I was that asshole kid. It was like, sure, it doesn't have double bass and screaming. It's not real music. And, you know, then you grow up and you're like,
but if you're doing that when you're 38.
Yeah. and a lot of people do. Yeah.
There's a lot of them.
So, I mean, yeah, dude, every tour I've ever worked, I've found a way, even if it was an artist that I like wasn't familiar with, I started to get to know their music. And there were times like, you know, Pat Benatar, you know, 80s rock legend. It's like,
yeah,
I knew some of her big songs when I started working for her, but I didn't know her whole discography. And man, like, throughout that tour, it was just like, God, there are such good songs that they have that I was never familiar with. And I was able to really enjoy all of the music. Like, Nick Jonas, dude, that would probably be one that other metalheads would be like, what? That guy's first solo album he released that had like Chains and Jealous and all that stuff on it, it was so good.
I bet he's also an incredible performer. I've never seen him, but I'm sure he's amazing.
He was great. He personality wise, he's a very quiet, shy person, but he's very nice. But the funnest thing about that tour, or most interesting thing, was his entire band, with the exception of like two people, had never toured in their lives.
Oh, wow.
He trusted his music director, who was his keyboard player, enough to just be like, find me a band. Like, wow. pick whoever you want. And this guy grew up on the west side of Chicago, his music director, and he went to his church in Chicago and got all these like 21-year-old gospel chop church players
right
to come play for Nick. And they are some of the best musicians I've ever toured with. But it was fun because every city we went to, it was their first time and they're young and they're excited. And it's like, this is so cool. And it was just a cool experience to, for somebody that had been touring for a while, to see that joy in somebody that's, you know, traveling right. for the first time and enjoying all of that. And it was fun. And the music was great.
You mentioned the gospel chops thing. And that's sort of, you know, there's this idea among a lot of metal people that like metal is the pinnacle of everything, you know, the best musicians and everyone that's not in the metal scene is a terrible person and blah, 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 like all these preconceived notions. And, you know, with you having worked with country and some of these gospel musicians and stuff, you know, you realize that's not true at all. And there's super talented, super cool people in every scene. And in fact, I mean, you would know better than I do, but based on my sort of limited experience, I think like the level of musicianship and professionalism in pop and country is really like probably the gold standard.
Pop and country is the pinnacle. When I first started doing pop and country tours, it blew my mind that some of these musicians were as good as they were. Because in metal, when a lot of metal players come up, they're like garage players. They're self-taught, yeah. which is awesome. That's super cool. That's how I taught myself. But a lot of these metal players are phenomenal at playing fast and shredding, and they know what they're yeah. doing. They're good musicians. Let's not take that away. But a lot of these pop and country players, they studied theory.
They can play anything.
Anything. And you have to when you're working for a country band. So what blew my mind whenever we saw, whenever we did country tours was, that first tour I ever did with Dustin, I was so shocked and blown away by how good his musicians were. And not only that, but their music theory that they had. Like a lot of these country shows, they have segments of their set where if it's like halfway through the set and they're trying to get the crowd fired up, they might cover some country classics like, you know, Friends in Low Places, yeah. you know, John Deere Green, something like that. So you'll randomly get your artist on stage, get into the talkback microphone to talk to everybody in the in-ears and be like, hey, let's do Friends in Low Places. And then you'll see the band. It's kind of magical. You'll see the band all start looking at each other and they'll be like, what are we going to play today? And they're like, A minor? You get with A minor? Yeah. A minor. Yeah. And that's all they need
just
to
go.
Know. And that's all they need to know.
And it sounds amazing.
Perfect example. Luke Bryan's bass player, current bass player, is a friend of mine. And when they just did that Crash My Playa festival in Mexico, Lionel Richie came down because he does, was it American Idol, I think, with Luke Bryan. Lionel wanted to play a spur of the moment set. And Luke's like, well, you can use my band. So with like 5 hours notice, his band got together and they asked Lionel what he wanted to play. And all these guys needed to do is listen to all the songs once, know what key it was going to be in, and just crush it like they've been doing it for years.
Yep.
So that's the difference, really, with pop and country. Most of the pop and country players are schooled musicians who can play anything in the spur of the moment. They know their instruments. They know their scales, their notes, everything. You know, my wife and I were watching Lizzo's live concert that's streaming the other night. And her band is just like, I know metalheads look at pop bands and they're like, nah, yeah, it's pop. Like, those players in those bands are some of the most skilled musicians in the world.
On the planet, because she is a giant global star,
mm-hmm.
and she wants only the absolute best. And anybody on earth, you know, that's like a session musician, you know, would drop whatever they're doing to play with her. So she is recruiting. She's like the NFL. She's recruiting from the best of the best of the best. Like, I don't know who plays bass for Lizzo, but I guarantee it's a bad, bad motherfucker.
Yeah. And her band is all female too. So,
okay.
And that is one thing in the music industry that I'm sure you're aware of, that like, you don't see that much. Like, yeah. even when I have toured, like as a roadie, it is not often that you get women on tour, because there is that sense of old school, men work harder, you know,
and girls won't fit in. And
yeah, I'll tell you right now, every woman I've worked with has like outworked every dude in their position on tour. And
well, they have to, unfortunately.
I was just going to say, I have had some of my women friends that I've toured with tell me like, we kind of have to compensate because people don't take us seriously on tour.
Yeah.
So Lizzo having an all female band, that pool of musicians that she's looking at is even smaller. So, you know, those women are probably the best of the best in the industry at their respective instruments. And it's just wild, man. And I saw recently Lizzo's doing a European tour right now. And I don't know if you saw like the headline on all the metal sites. They're like, Lizzo did this funny bit in her set where she started, you know, talking to the crowd. And she was like, do host. And she was like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Trying to, you know, be funny and just have fun with the crowd.
Yeah.
Dude, metalheads are ripping her apart on the internet right now because they're dumb. They're stupid. They're like,
what did she do? Because she said a Rammstein lyric. Is there something wrong with that?
How dare she make fun of Rammstein like that? And like, she wishes she was half as talented as those guys. I'm like, you guys are such assholes for a community.
Dude, she is so ridiculous. I find her irritating as a person, but yeah, she is fucking absurdly talented as a musician.
Oh, it's unreal.
It's absurd.
But I made a comment on, I think, Loudwire or Metal Feed or whatever, where, because all the comments, you get internet trolls that they can't come up with original comments. So everybody, literally all the comments were making fun of her after that for being, you know, fat and black. That, yeah, literally, of course. That's all the insults.
No, that's what it is.
And I was like, you know, the metal community has always talked about itself being so tolerant and inclusive of everybody. And like, we're friendly with everybody. I'm like, that is not true, man. At all.
No, unfortunately.
No, unfortunately, it's not. And I just couldn't believe it. I was like, you know, for a community that tries to act like it's so tolerant and accepting of everybody, it's one of the most judgmental communities. And I know I'll probably get railed on for saying that, but it's the truth. I've been a metalhead since I've been an early teenager, and that is 100% the truth.
It is. And I've noticed, like, on that note, as you said, the metal fans never want to admit this, and they always insist that it's so inclusive and like, oh, well, we can't be racist because look, you know, Seven Dust exists. Well, I'll tell you what, anytime I mention someone who is female or black or even worse, both, the comments are like very noticeably more negative every time.
Yeah, it's insane, dude.
Like, is that a coincidence?
No, unfortunately. And it's funny, you know, Claire, my wife, she, up until we had our daughter, she was in a dance company in Nashville for years. She's been a choreographer and a professional dancer her entire life. And we have a lot of friends that are black or in the LGBTQ community. And we've had conversations with them about this stuff. And it's like, the fact that every time Seven Dust gets brought up, a band that's been around for 25 years, probably a little longer, the fact that, hey, did you know they have a black singer? It's like, yeah, he's been in the band for 25 years. Why? Like, the fact that that's still getting brought up by people shows that like they're trying to be hip and be like, oh yeah, I like a band right, with a black guy in it. It's like, dude, you know, I don't know. I just don't get it. And it's the same with female singers. It's like, yep, anytime there's a female singer, people act like they're so blown away. They're like, wow. And I'm like, dude, I mean, we were listening to like, you remember like Kitty and OTEP mm-hmm. back in the day. It's like, there have been female bands like this forever, but for some reason, I think there's a sense that sometimes metalheads, to prove that they are so, you know, open and non-judgmental, they want to like a band that has a black person in it, or they want to like a band that has a female in it, so they can say like, I don't have any prejudices. I listen to Ginger. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they have a female singer. So I could talk about this forever because it does annoy me. And it's not everybody. Let's be very clear. Like,
sure,
there are some wonderful people in the metal community. There are also some terrible people.
But it's enough people that, like, I think it's bullshit. And I'm not saying this is what you're doing, but I think it's bullshit to just pretend like it's some tiny number of people that don't matter. All right, well, I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comments that reflect this. Like, how many hundreds of comments do you need to see before you admit that, okay, actually it might be a problem.
100%. And anytime I've said something about like being like pro LGBTQ or something like that, dude, I get the comments on my YouTube channel. Yeah. Like all of a sudden I'm the woke libtard that, like, you know,
right.
It's like, you know, when I did the Lorna Shore video for Pain Remains, like on an emotional level, that song hit me very hard because I was able to connect to it and relate to it. And there were people that were, you know, making fun of me for just showing emotion. And I'm just like,
yeah,
just drop the tough guy act. Like, it's not impressing anybody. And to be 100% fair, it's not just metal. It's every music community, because country is also horrible. Like, there are some horrible things in the country industry as well.
I'm sure.
When we do summer country festivals, dude, I can't tell you the amount of Confederate flags that are waving at the festival crowds and like the crazy. And then, like, you know, they have one black fan that'll show up, and then all of the hillbillies that are there will be like, see, we're inclusive. Right. Like, we've got black people.
Cowboy
here
Troy
us.
Exists.
Like, oh my God, dude. Yeah. Like, Cowboy, I can't believe you just name dropped Cowboy Troy, dude.
I actually listen to a lot of country. Like, mostly I listen to like pop and country.
Yeah.
Especially like pop country.
So I did a tour with Big and Rich like way back in the day, and Cowboy Troy was like,
yeah,
he was the one person that would come to the merch table every night when I was doing merch and like sign autographs and hang with people. So I've spent some time with him. That dude is funnier than hell.
Yeah, he seems like it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it obviously, like, this stuff exists in every scene and every genre, but I mean, I think it's a real problem. Like, to me, like, you know, if you've seen my videos, you know that I think of like, how do we make this kind of music more mainstream? And any kind of like backward, bigoted kind of beliefs among fans is just absolute cancer in terms of making the genre more relevant and mainstream, because that rightfully gets less and less acceptable every year. And like, you compare that with pop, you know, or rap or anything else, like, there was like zero room for people like that. Zero. Like, you cannot, like, imagine being like anti-woman or anti-black in the pop world. It can't exist.
Yeah. And it's like, we're at a point in the metal community where metal is getting popular again. I mean, you've got, dude, I never thought I'd see a day where deathcore bands are selling out tours in advance. It's bonkers.
And hitting the, you know, Spotify viral top 50.
It's crazy. And it's metal right now is starting to get like, it's almost like we're back in like the turn of the century when new metal was mainstream. Like, extreme metal is starting to get mainstream. And with the metal community, again, it likes to act like it's all like loving and inclusive and stuff like that. People need to stop pretending that it's like that and call it out when it's not.
Yep.
Because I see it way too much, man. And it bums me out. There are definitely days as a metalhead where I see comments on certain posts and stuff like that, and I'm just like, God, I don't want to be associated with any of these people.
I mean, like, as an example of this, that blows my mind. So Nurgle from Behemoth is friends with the guy from Graveland. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They're a literal, actual Nazi band. I'm not being like one of these like woke people that calls any Republican a Nazi. Like, the guy is in a band that Sieg Heils and has swastikas and stuff. And Nurgle takes pictures with him and calls him a good friend and was like on a Graveland album back in the day. And everyone's like, oh, well, you know, whatever. Why do we have to bring politics into this? And like, the dude is a literal Nazi and you people are like indifferent to this. Like, what world am I living in?
And you hear the argument from people a lot where they're like, well, you know, you just got to learn to separate the artist from the art.
No,
like,
I don't.
No. Yeah, you don't. It's right now. It's the conversation that people are having about Phil from Pantera.
Right.
Like, do I think that Phil is an actual like neo-Nazi dude? I really don't.
Probably
I think,
not. Yeah.
I think he's just one of those like, I know so many people I've toured with that are in like their 40s that still act like an edgy 14-year-old because they get a rise out of people and they just like to be edgy. And, you know, you see the clips of Phil doing the fucking Sieg Heils and stuff like that. And you're like, do I actually think he's a Nazi? No. Is this appropriate, though? Absolutely not. But there are so many people that are defending him and that are like, well, you know, it's Phil. Like, you know, it's just Phil goofing around. Or like screaming white power and doing Hitler salutes is not a joke. Like, it's not funny.
Even if he meant it as a joke, it's not it's a
terrible
okay.
joke.
End of story. The end, period.
Yeah.
And like you've seen the clip of Dimebag at NAMM. Someone asked him to sign a guitar.
Yeah.
And he says, can that N-word play? N-word with a hard R.
Oh, God. I know. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
And I love Pantera's music with all my heart. They're one of my favorite bands of all time. And I don't want that to be true. But it's like, dude, if you're Sieg Heiling on stage and saying white power and Dimebag with a totally straight face says the N-word with a hard R, just like it's nothing. Like, what do you like? You can't deny it. You got to just admit, like, if it looks like a duck and it walks like a duck, then it is a duck. And I hate saying that because I absolutely love Pantera, but like, we can't make excuses for this.
Yeah, I agree. And I think Rob Flynn, I know people hate on Rob Flynn from Machine Head, but like, not all of his takes I agree with. Like, he does say some stuff where I'm like, whatever. But after that thing happened with Phil at the Dime Bash, Rob had a really good take on that and was like, guys, we need to stop giving passes to these artists for their actions just because we like their music so much.
Yep.
And you had a fantastic video on that whole separating the art from the artist and make up your own decision about how you want to support them with what they've done. And I loved that video because a good example of that for me is Tim Lambesis.
Yeah.
Like, I will not listen to Azalea Dying anymore. I won't.
No, never.
I have friends that do. I'm not going to shame them for it. I'm not going to judge them for it. Whatever. That's their choice. But for me on a personal level with my morals and what I believe, I cannot support something like that, like with a person that has done something like that. And Pantera is one of those for me too. I love that band. I've loved their music, but I look at their career and I'm just like, oh, this is a bummer.
It's a huge bummer. I don't want it to be true, but I'm not going to deny reality.
Yeah. And you always get the fans that I don't even think they're trying to defend the band. I think they're trying to defend themselves from supporting the band, because you hear everything, especially about Pantera. It's like, well, they're from Texas. You know, that's how they were back then. You know, oh, they're from a different generation. They talk different. I was like, dude, if people can change and grow up, because I'll be honest, like I've said this many times on my channel, I'm not an angel here. Dude, when I was when I was a teenager, dude, I used horrible derogatory language because
I said horrible shit in my 30s.
Yeah, like we're in a certain place where we just don't think about it. And like, eventually you grow, you change, or you don't. And unfortunately, some people just don't.
Yeah, it's sad. Well, I wanted to ask you a couple things about YouTube before I let you go. In particular, you did a video saying, you know, that 2023 was going to be different for you. And you mentioned that you were having anxiety attacks and stuff like that. And just in general, that YouTube was maybe not great for your mental health, which I resonate deeply with that, obviously. Can you talk about that and kind of where you're at with that now?
Yeah. I mean, when I first started doing YouTube, I never thought it was even going to turn into anything. It was a pandemic boredom thing because we couldn't tour and, you know, and then it turned into what it has now. And it's still fun. I won't say it's not fun. If it wasn't, I wouldn't be doing it. But it has become stressful. It's the constant pressure of not only having content on time because I'm, you know, we have a kid and I'm touring again. I literally just got back from home from tour yesterday and I'm like looking at my schedule and I'm like, God, I got to record like 3 videos in the next day to stay on schedule. And there are some days where I just don't want to do it.
Yeah.
But then there's the pressure of, you know, I'm doing less and less reactions. And when I don't do the reactions to what people want to see, I hear about it. And that's all I get in comments. And that gets stressful. So a few months, about 6 months back, man, I just started getting these random anxiety attacks and it's never happened. And it's like debilitating. It's like, I'll get to a point where my chest gets all tight and I feel like something bad's going to happen and I can't breathe. And I'm like, I was never having this before until I started doing all this social media content. And I know there's people out there that are just like, well, what you guys do is easy. you're just making videos sitting at your computer. And I'm like,
and they're right. We're not working on the coal mines.
Yeah, for sure. There is a lot more work that goes into it than I think the normal person thinks about. I mean, recording the video, like right now, while we're doing this, this is the easy part.
Yeah.
Like after this, because this is your podcast, like you're going to have to edit this and make a thumbnail and set it all up for that. You know, I did this last night with another podcast I have coming out. And there's a lot more time that I've put into this than I ever thought there would be. And I think it's finally starting to take like a mental toll where it's like, you know, I need to start focusing more on just me being happy and healthy than trying to pump out content. And it also, I think a lot of that too is a financial thing. You know, over the pandemic, we couldn't tour. And that's, if I'm being honest, that's all I know, man. Like I could probably go work at Guitar Center or something like that, but like not necessarily music, but like instruments and touring is all I know. And because of that, and I want to stay home with the kid, YouTube is what I've put all my energy into. And as you know, during certain times of the year, ad revenue goes down and stuff. And
very stressful. Like, oh, cool. My paycheck is 40% lower this month.
Dude, that would happen December to January. My paycheck was literally probably 60 or 70% lower, to be honest. And that's stressful because YouTube, up until recently when I started touring again, has been what's paid our bills over the pandemic. And if that revenue goes down, it means, damn, maybe I can't pay one of my bills this month. And that's, I don't know. All this stuff has just been adding up. And I finally think it boiled over to the point where I actually went and saw like a doctor about it. And they were like most doctors do, they were just like, we can give you medication. And I was like, yeah. I mean, is therapy an option? Because I probably feel like I have a lot of stuff that I've never unpacked ever that I think I'd benefit more from talking it out than just taking medication. Not that I'm opposed to taking the medication.
It's harder to get therapy than it is to get medication, yeah. Which is insane. Like, oh, well, it's 3 months to see a therapist and your insurance doesn't cover it. Like, but you'll just give me a controlled substance?
Yeah. And I was having a conversation with my dad about this the other day. The last few months, I think I've turned into a hypochondriac, dude, because I've been having so many panic attacks and I've been feeling so weird. It's something that's never happened to where now it's like every 2 minutes of the day, I'm like checking my heart rate on my Fitbit. I'm taking like, I have a blood pressure thing sitting here and I keep doing all these things and it's maddening. Like I'm driving myself crazy over my health because I can't figure out where it's coming from or how to fix it yet. You know,
I never had any problems sleeping in my entire life until about 2 years ago. I started having like nighttime panic attacks, maybe 3 years ago. Yeah, probably about 3 years ago. I have started having these nighttime panic attacks. And I don't know for sure that it's because of social media, but it seems like it's pretty likely.
Yeah.
Getting berated by hundreds and hundreds of people constantly, having a different Reddit thread every week about what a horrible person I am. Seems likely.
Yeah, dude. And I'm gonna admit this to you since we're sitting here talking. One of the hardest things, especially even for me before I started doing YouTube, was all you see about a person that does content creation is whatever you see in their videos.
Yeah.
And then you can formulate your own opinion. You don't see this person as, you almost dehumanize the person that you're looking at on social media. And that's where a lot of that comes from. Like, I know that there's people, like when people talk shit to me on my YouTube and stuff like that, and call me gay or whatever. It's like 2023, find a better insult, you know?
Yeah.
You know, they don't see the me off screen where I've been married for 10 years and I have a 2-year-old daughter and I have dogs that I love. And, you know, just like, I have a great life. I'm not going to complain. Like, I'm happy. I'm married. We have a beautiful child. But people don't see that. So when they go on the attack online, they just see content creator or whatever, and yeah, they say whatever they want. You know, one of the most, you know, and I what I was going to say is when I first started doing content, didn't realize that. I was like the person, when I first started doing YouTube, I was that person that when I looked at other YouTubers, I kind of dehumanized them as well, until I started understanding like, oh, you know, they're people. Like, we're all people, you know?
Yeah. You see like one facet of this person on YouTube, which is, I don't want to say a character, but you know, it's like just you know, same way as an artist when they're on stage is not the same person as when they're off stage.
100%. And my wife realizes, she knows when I get done with my Twitch streams on the weekend, like I need like a half hour to decompress because I've been on for 3 hours. Like,
yeah,
I'm not putting on a character and I'm not being fake, but there is a sense of you have to be on. And it gets exhausting.
It's not the same energy as if someone was sitting in a room with you, just like having chatting over coffee.
Yeah. Like right now in terms of content is like the most like real. I feel like we're just sitting here having a conversation. I don't have to be on for my stream or my video. But I'll admit there were people that I looked at on YouTube, you being one of them, where I was like, I'd hear some of your takes on things and I'd be like,
fuck that guy.
I don't know if I ever said it that extreme, but I was like, nah, this guy's, you know, I was like, yeah, Finn just says stuff to rile people up. Like he probably doesn't even believe in his blah, 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 whatever. And then you start to get to know people. Like, dude, I used to rip on Alex Hefner so much. And then I got to know him and I'm like, I love this guy, you know? And that's one of the things too, is the difference between people's upbringings is like, when I first started doing YouTube, the crowd that I surrounded myself with was not the crowd that I should have. It was bad for my mental health and I acted like an idiot. And I thought that my content was better because I'm being real and I'm only watching stuff that these are authentic reactions, and all these other people that say they've never heard Nirvana before are lying. And then I really legitimately started realizing, like, you know, like I look at Alex Hefner and Nick Nocturnals, those guys are like 25.
Yeah.
And it's like, so now thinking about that and thinking about how they grew up and what they were, you know, open to when they were younger, it's like, okay, it does make sense that somebody like Alex Hefner probably didn't listen to Slipknot until now because he wasn't a teenager like I was.
I mean, I've never listened to the Isley Brothers or something in my life.
Yeah. So
why would I?
I think there actually is a lot more authenticity to a lot of YouTube reactions than people might think.
And by the way, even if it's not, like, I've made fun of it, but like, I don't give a shit.
Yeah. It's entertaining.
Like if people enjoy it, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, if it makes people happy for them, I'm not saying that any of those people are doing anything fake, but like, if it makes their audience happy to watch them or anyone fake react to hearing Nirvana for the first time, so what? I'm still going to make a joke about it, but I don't actually care.
Yeah. When I first started doing content, I think I cared more than I do now about what other people were doing. And now I don't at all. It's like, I'm not worried about what everybody else is doing. I do my thing. And I've made great friends in the YouTube community now that I talk to a lot. And it's, again, it when I first started out, I fell into that trap of dehumanizing a lot of other fellow content creators. And now I don't. I have a completely different outlook. And that has been one step better for my mental health, worrying less about other people's content and just worrying about mine. But, you know, it does. There are times where out of nowhere, it will get bad. Like the worst day I ever had on YouTube, and I know it was the worst day because of how I felt. I did a video calling out Nightwish, a band that I enjoy, to be honest. Mm-hmm. This is fact. They are the most reacted to band on YouTube.
I did not know that.
That is an actual fact because their fans have a Discord server where they log every reaction that's ever made to a Nightwish song.
Oh, no.
And it's, dude, it's tens of thousands. It's nuts.
So you ended up in their crosshairs.
Because of what I said, their management is very strict about their copyrights. They are signed with Nuclear Blast Records, a label that is very cool to work with, that I've worked with many things, that will gladly clear copyrights when I check out new releases. But I was told by them they can clear anything but Nightwish, because Nightwish's management has said that they do not support reactors and will not unblock and uncopyright claim videos.
Okay, which is their right.
100%.
Even if you think it's maybe a bad decision, you do not have the right to use their content.
Exactly. And that's why I don't do Nightwish reactions anymore, because when I found that out, I was like, if they don't approve of it, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
But they made a post one day bragging about how they were the most reacted to band it was an Instagram post where they were like, we're the most reacted to band on YouTube and blah, blah, blah. And like,
well, then why do you block everything?
And that's what I made my video about. And I called it out and I was just like, this is such a hypocritical thing. And the fans need to understand that while they're sitting here bragging about all these reactions and how they're so popular on YouTube, behind the scenes, they are actively making sure that videos aren't unblocked and they have copyright claims on them. They will manually copyright claim stuff if one slips through the cracks. Their diehards went after me, dude. Like, and I usually can separate out negative comments and be like, whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But for some reason, it was so overwhelming that day was like probably the most like, the closest to being full on depressed I've ever been, because that was the first time I ever felt like the full brunt force of internet negativity directly aimed at me, where I was like, this sucks. Like, I don't want to do this.
It does suck. I mean, obviously it's not the worst thing in the world, but it sucks to have like hundreds or thousands, because this has happened to me many times, hundreds or thousands of people just fucking hammering you and telling you all kinds of horrible things for like several days. It sucks.
Yeah. It's not fun. It's like,
it sucks. And I think what you said is a pretty reasonable thing. It's not like you were calling them names for how they look or something like that. I mean, you're talking about business. That's fair game.
Yeah. And I specifically said in that video too, I was like, this might not be a Nightwish band related thing. This could be their management calling the shots. And you know, fans are very protective of the bands that they love and they don't want to hear bad things. But even though I specifically made sure I said, this might not be the band making this call. That doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They just,
people hear what they want to hear.
Dude, it got so bad that like, I just stopped looking at comments completely.
Yeah.
But then it started spilling into other videos. And then people were like, I'd post a video 2 weeks later and, you know, people would still be on there being,
have you reevaluated your stupid opinion on Nightwish yet?
it's like,
fuck, man, let it go.
Yeah. And people, you know, you say one criticism from something and then people think, you know, you hate it. So it's like,
yeah,
you know, there was somebody I know that has a good like analogy for this, where it's like, somebody's like, hey, what's your favorite color? And, you know, I say red and they're like, oh, so you hate blue then? I was like, I didn't say that. That's how people on the internet act. If you don't overwhelmingly like something, it means you hate it. That's how people take it.
This is why I stopped putting any kind of critical opinions in my main channel video, because I just don't want to hear it. I don't like, all people want is for me to praise bands they like. So that's what I do now.
Yeah.
Which sucks. I don't love that, but that's what they want. So that's what they get.
But you can't win. Because then when you praise too many bands, people are like, oh, they're not being honest. And, you know, I've had it happen. Like, I genuinely love music. And even if I don't necessarily like a song, I always try and find something about the actual music itself that I can enjoy. So even if I don't like a song, I'm like, hey, this was mixed and produced very well. And some of the parts are cool, but the song itself didn't hit me, whatever. And I've had a handful of reactions on my channel that, I've said straight up, like, production sounds great, the video is cool, it's just this song didn't do anything for me. And it's happened with bands I like, I absolutely love Sabaton, and one of their last singles they released, I did the reaction and I was just like, yeah, this one it's just not doing it for me. Just, you know, and their fans were like, what? But you love this band. How can you not like this? I'm like, because every song can't be a banger.
Right.
Like, you know. Music is such a emotional, personal connection to things that it's like every single song isn't going to get me. Like, you know, there are some of my favorite bands where if I'm listening to an album, there might be a certain song that I skip, even if it's one of my favorite bands. I just didn't like the song. It's not a big deal.
Well, on that note, I'm going to let you go because I got somebody calling me that I need to talk to, but I could talk to you all day. I appreciate this, and I will talk to you soon.
For sure, dude. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Talk to you later. Bye.
See you, buddy.
All right, my friends, that does it for this episode of the podcast. If you made it this far, thank you. Thank you for listening. We sincerely appreciate each and every one of you. If you want to help the show, there's a couple things that you can do. First of all, share it on social media. If you share it, tag us, tag Finn McKenty, that's me, and tag Deanna Chapman, that's a producer. Second thing you can do, if you really, really, really love us and really want to support us, you can support us on Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to this, or you can do none of that. And you can just sit at home, think about how awesome this podcast is. That works too. Again, thank you very much to each and every one of you for listening. We sincerely appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast.